You're listening to the winning literary show, Off the Shelf Books Talk Radio, live with host Denise Turney, author of the books Long Walk Up, Portia, Love Pour Over Me, Spiral, Love Has Many Faces, and Rosetta's Great Hope. Turn up your dial and get ready for a blast of feature author interviews, 411 on book festivals, writing conferences, and so much more. Ready? Let's go.
Don't wait for opportunity, create it. And that quote is attributed to an anonymous source. Don't wait for opportunity, create it. Welcome, welcome, welcome to today's March 23rd. This month has gone so fast. I feel like March just started, and it's almost coming to an end. I'm telling you, if there is something you want to do, if those of you who've been here with us, the 18 years Off the Shelf Books has been going, have heard me say this before, you ain't got time to wait. Don't wait for opportunity, create it, because this time goes so fast. It's like blazing fast. So to those who have been here with us 18 years, I just have to, every show, say thank you, thank you, thank you. I honor you, I appreciate you, and I thank you. If this is your first time, and there's so many places to catch Off the Shelf around the globe, we're on so many different platforms. If it's your first time and you're just looking for something to do Saturday and you rolled on over here, so happy to have you. And I want to let you know that you absolutely are listening to the winning book podcast, Off the Shelf. And again, welcome to our Saturday, March 23rd show. We have a wonderful author on deck for you. This is why you set your calendars to catch Off the Shelf Books Saturdays, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time or New York City time. And it's the time for you to let your friends know they can catch the show live by dialing 347-994-3490. Don't let your friends miss out on this treat. Again, it's 347-994-3490. Before we get into today's show, it's so important. Years ago, I used to go, whether I was traveling to market my books, working a demanding full-time job, raising my sons as a single parent. I was just, I never sat down. And when I did sit down and rest, I felt guilty. And so now I've learned the value of rest. There's so much for us to learn to better care for and love ourselves. And I think the way we feel about and treat ourselves, we project that outwards, and that's the way we actually treat other people. So if you really, really, really want to work on healing, living the life you're meant to live, and I think that's a life full with joy, peace, and you know you're loved and you share love, I encourage you to get a copy of Heal Gorgeous. Wisdom within you. It's in you. It knows the way. Heal Gorgeous. Wisdom within you knows the way. It's an ebook, paperback, and hardback by yours truly, Denise Turney. It is a book of short poetic writings. I'd be shocked if it didn't leave you in a better state. Heal Gorgeous. Wisdom within you knows the way. And now let us go and meet our very special off-the-shelf guest this morning. And this morning's guest is Joe Clifford. And Joe is the author of several novels. He's written a whole lot of books, including The One That Got Away, The Shadow People, The Lake House, All Who Wonder. This is not even all his books. A Junkie Love, Say My Name, and A Moth to Flame. Joe is also the author of the J. Porter book series. It's a thriller series published by Ocean View Publishing. His books have earned rave reviews from periodicals such as Publishers Weekly, the San Francisco Chronicle, and Library Journal. In addition to writing, Joe works as an editor, working on projects such as Trouble in the Heartland, crime stories based on the songs of Bruce Springsteen, and Just to Watch Him Die, crime fiction inspired by the songs of Johnny Cash. And as if that's not enough, Joe also teaches writing online at Florida International University, where he earned his MFA in 2008. Please check Joe Clifford out online at joeclifford.com, and that's J-O-E, joecliffford.com. Again, joecliffford.com. You can even enjoy checking out his website, joecliffford.com, while you listen to today's show. We are absolutely honored to have Joe Clifford here with us on Off the Shelf this morning. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
And I enjoyed when I was doing the research for your interview. I was like, whoa, he has written a lot of books, and your journey here is an interesting and an intriguing journey, which we'll explore a little. And you have so many books, we're not going to be able to cover them all during today's show. But I want to make sure our listeners know more and more about your wonderful books and your writing. So to kick it off, Joe, when I open up Off the Shelf, I ask every guest the same 3 to 4 questions so our listeners can get a little backstory on a guest before I launch into talking about their books. So to kick off today's show, can you tell Off the Shelf listeners where you grew up and what life was like for you growing up?
For sure. I feel bad throwing this in there, but you missed him, a musician as well. I have a band, The Wandering.
Oh,
just
the
released
musician,
a record.
Okay.
It's okay. Now it's something I'm bragging. Now, I grew up in Connecticut, a small farm town called Berlin. Not like Berlin, spelled the same way, like Berlin in Germany, but people got very mad if you pronounced it Berlin, so it's Berlin. A very tiny town, very few people, a couple of cows, a bank, a donut shop, and that's how I spent the first 20 years of my life.
Oh, okay. Siblings, it sounds like this small town. Siblings?
Yeah, you know, you're opening a big can there. I have one sister, one amazing sister, who's about to expect her second child in, oh, I'd say any minute now. She's getting pretty big.
Wow.
She's wonderful. She's like 12 years younger than I am, so she was always found between that sweet spot between a younger sister and kind of like, you know, a form of daughter somewhat. Our parents are gone, so I feel like I have more of a parental responsibility with her, although she's far more mature than I am. And our other brother, we have a brother, Josh, and his presence looms over everything I do. Joshua was my best friend. He passed away in 2017 from alcoholism and drug addiction. And these are the things I talk about. And we'll definitely talk about Josh because there's nothing I do, including the new record, which is pretty much all about him, and the new book that's coming out in September that's pretty much all about him, and Junkie Love, which is very much about the experience we had being a couple of bad kids on the streets. Josh is a specter that looms and haunts just about everything I do. He never really, you know, if you've lost somebody who's close to you like that, you know they never really leave you. You hear their voice, you feel their presence. I live on the West Coast, so sorry for this hippy dippy stuff, but you know, Josh is still with me. You know, there's a great line by Bruce Springsteen talking about when Clarence Clemons died. He said, "Clarence Clemons doesn't leave the E Street Band when he dies. Clarence Clemons leaves the E Street Band when we die." And I love that. I love that because it allows us to keep the people who are no longer on this mortal coil journey with us, you know, with us.
Yes. Now, as a kid, Joe, what did you dream of being when you grew up?
Sadly, a writer. I wanted to be an artist.
Oh, okay.
I mean, my first goal was to be a right field the first base for the New York Yankees. Sadly, I couldn't catch a ball. I couldn't hit a curveball. I possessed very little athletic ability. My brother, on the other hand, went to the 1996 Olympics Olympic trials for wrestling. He was an amazing athlete.
Wow.
I got blessed with the other half of the equation. All the things that don't make you money. You know, I can paint. I can play music. I can sing. I can write. I can do everything but dance. And yeah, a career in the arts seemed to be my destiny from day one.
Interesting. You know, this is rare for Off the Shelf. We've had so many guests on, from movie producers to songwriters to New York Times bestselling authors, et cetera. Very few wanted to be a writer when they were a kid, they almost just stumble, most just stumble into it. Now, who or what inspired you to pursue writing? Where did that love for books come from for you?
Well, before I forget, because you just because you said that, stumble into writing, it just reminds me of a story of Peter Bush, who's a judge in San Francisco, and I often teach with him up at the Book Passage Writers Conference in Corte Madera. And he has this great line about how one becomes a judge. He says, one doesn't just become a judge. There's no direct career path line. It just sort of happens. And I feel that way about being a writer. Like, it just sort of happens. So I just love that anecdote. Mm-hmm. Anyways, what inspired me? My mother was a reader. She really loved books. She turned me on to the Great Brain series, I think was the first book series that really, really grabbed my attention. And then later on, my friend Jimmy, I stopped reading because I went through that rebellious teenage phase where I listened to nothing but Pink Floyd and looked gloomy. And then my friend Jimmy was like, "Hey man, you wanna live this kind of life you're talking about being an artist? You gotta read. You know, you wanna be a writer? You gotta read." I mean, I was always writing, and I was reading here and there. Yeah, The Dead Zone stands out as one of the greatest things that I remember reading when I was like 15. And there's a handful of other books, but when you're in high school, unfortunately, I feel like the canon that's forced sort of down your throat are not really books that appeal or speak to that particular age. I mean, what can a 16-year-old relate to in The Scarlet Letter? I'm not saying it's not a great, fantastic story. I'm not saying anything bad about Nathaniel Hawthorne. I'm just saying, it's very difficult to relate those two worlds. I wish high schools, would share more of The Hunger Games or share more of, whatever is popular now. I'm 53 years old. I don't know what popular is. I barely know what the ticky-tock is. I can barely internet. I'm getting old. I'm losing touch with technology. But I do think that there must be a bunch of books out there that would relate more to fellow teenagers,
Yeah, and I agree. I remember when we were kids and plays, we would go through. The arts were more in school when I was growing up. They don't seem to be as much in the arts as much. But, yeah, you read stories that you're like, okay, this is from way back when, and I'm really not really – it's not up to the time that we're living in. I would agree with you. I think a lot of schools stick with the classics, and that's why you end up reading those stories. You're like, this happened way, way long ago. So you might have trouble as a kid relating to this story. But talking about stories, Joe, where did the idea for the J. Porter thriller series come from?
God, I feel like this is going to be a reoccurring answer. But once again, my brother Josh, worked for you probably heard of Paul Manafort, the guy that worked for Trump, the guy that went to jail. It's a very small family in Connecticut. There's only like 12 of them. It's a made-up family name. If you hear Manafort, they all come from the same family. Paul Manafort and Frank Manafort had a company, a construction company. Their sons then branched off into politics. One, Paul, who you know about, who went to jail for his criminal activity, and Frank, who went into construction. My father worked for Frank. My brother married a cousin of the Manaforts. Anyways, the family, I will try to say this nicely, are not very nice people. That doesn't include all of them. Some of them are wonderful. My brother's stepdaughter was amazing. His ex-wife's fine. But Frank and Paul are not good people. I'm sure hearing Paul Manafort's not a good person is not a surprise. But there was a lot of stuff that I knew I was privy to, behind-the-scenes information that allowed me to meld fiction in the real world and tell a story about how our father died. He was sent to work in contaminated fields that they knew were poisonous and decided the wrongful death suit payout would be cheaper than cleanup. That's the price of, capitalism and working, and that's what my father signed up for. And he died very young, 56. Everybody in my family has died really young. I'm the oldest living Clifford to my knowledge, and I'm pushing 54. We died to the ripe old age of childbirth, like pilgrims. But that was the impetus.
So that's what a J. Porter thrill. So introduce us to J. Porter. How old is Jay? What drives him? What's his personality like?
Well, Jay is based, the Jay character is based on my half-brother, Jason, who lives in New Hampshire, one of my father's many offsprings from his several illicit affairs. Jason is was working in estate clearing, and that's what Jay Porter does. And I just love this story. Jason was telling me one day of how he would go to this woman's, and they were lived in such a small town up in, I make up the town called Ashton, New Hampshire, but it was based on a real town. I think it was Twin Mountain. And the town was so small, they would go to this woman's house every morning before work, and she would serve them breakfast from her kitchen, like on her counter, you know, $2 for some eggs and toast. I just love the intimacy of that. Jay worked in estate clearing, Jason, and that's basically when people would die, he would go to their houses, and usually they didn't have any family left, and they had a bunch of materials and things they've acquired over the years hanging around, and then they'd bid on them. So this idea of a man alone in the mountains, in the cold, in the snow, estranged from his wife, estranged from his child, you know, trying to find something worthwhile from the worthless, you know, scavenging, really appealed to me. I love that hard scrabble idea. I've always been drawn to that blue collar Springsteen working class hero. I don't want to say vibe because I'll sound so Californian, but I can't think of another word, so I'll say vibe. And I watched my father work that life. I watched my brother work that life. I was never cut out for that life. I was much like Ben Stiller's character in Zoolander. You know, he goes down the mines. I don't know if that's too obscure a reference, but maybe you get it. I just, you know, soft hands, wasn't as big as they were. My dad was a big man. He was 6'4 and 250. My brother was 6'5 and 300 pounds. I am 6 feet and 200 pounds, and all I ever heard my entire life is, why are you so small? And
Oh my God!
It's not small. I'm a big guy, but compared to those two behemoths, you know, I was a small guy. But yeah, they worked in the fields. They worked with their hands. They were in that. There's something romantic about that life to me, especially not having had to have gone through it. I imagine I wouldn't look at through the same romantic lens. But when you're a writer, you view the world in your own unique perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a synopsis of the first book in the Jay Porter series? What's happening in book one in the series?
Well, book one, very much I borrow from real life. I have Jay, who is, like I said, the character's based on my half-brother, Jay. But the character's mostly a stand-in for me, like I think a lot of main characters are for the writer. And he has a brother, Chris, who is a drug addict, very much based on my brother, Josh. And one night, Jay is clearing out an old farmhouse, and he gets a call from the local police that his brother, Chris, has been picked up. Again, he's often picked up by police along the turnpike for various illicit activities. And this time, Chris is swearing that he's found a hard drive that contains the secrets that'll blow this whole town wide apart, and much like the delusional rantings of many a drug addict, Chris's claims are dismissed by Jay, who says, nah, you can sleep on my couch tonight, but tomorrow, if anything's missing, you're never coming back. That's it. Well, he wakes up the next morning, Chris is gone. Mm-hmm. And that sets in motion the mystery of not only where Chris is, but what was on the hard drive. And that's the plot of, you know, with mystery series, you're supposed to make each book a standalone, and each book does stand alone. But there's also there's an overarching theme and narrative that runs throughout all the books. It tells a bigger picture. So I try to do the best of both worlds, have each book be a standalone, but also tell this bigger story of corruption and corporate greed and ego politics, and really bring to light what the Manafort family did to my father and brother.
Wow. Oh my God! So you're like weaving some real life events and some of your characters' personalities into your books. And I want to ask you, this wasn't a question I had planned to ask you previously, but has anybody read the Jay Porter series and said you're writing about has anybody picked up, like, oh, you're writing about, have you heard that from anybody who's read any other books?
You know what's funny is you, as a writer, when you begin writing, you know, you tap into this different part of the brain, and it's so hard to explain to somebody who's not an artist, but there really is this, I don't want to say muse, because again, I'm sounding like such a Berkeley guy, and I really am an East Coast man at heart. But there's something else guiding the writing, and it wasn't until the second book, maybe, that I got a message from our neighbor back east and saying, like, wow, I can't believe you're writing about the Manafort's. Because in the book, they're going to call the Lombardi brothers, and one's in politics and one's in construction. I didn't even realize what I was doing. And when he pointed that out, I was like, oh, my God, that's what I'm writing about. That's what this story is about. It hit me by surprise as much as it hit, I think, some other people by surprise. But then it all tied together. Once I realized that's what I was writing about, it brought it all together. It gave me the rest of the arc.
Oh, my God. That is really something that as a writer you didn't even notice that you were doing that, and a reader noticed it. Now, can you give us an overview of one of your newer books, A Moth to Flame?
Sure. A Moth to Flame is probably my most sophisticated, intricately plotted, deftly characterized, involved, mature novel I've written to date. And if that sounds like a plug and a desperate plea for people to buy the book, it is, because for some reason it is not moving as much as I thought it would. It's really frustrating as a writer. It's a wonderful thing as a writer when your first book, and in my case, Junkie Love, gets the attention it does. No matter who I talk to, anybody who's a fan of my work, this book was good, but man, Junkie Love, because Junkie Love tells the story of the 10 years I spent homeless in San Francisco as a drug addict on the streets, and there's something about that true story and redemptive element that seeps through and really resonates with people. But each book, as a writer, you strive to get better. I strive to get better. Each book I write, I try to be the best writer I can be and produce the best book I can. So I'm on my 20th novel, something like that. So A Moth to Flame, I feel like I really have honed my craft. A Moth to Flame, I was able to work with my thesis advisor back at FIU, Lynn Barrett, who is without a doubt the smartest person I've ever met in my life, and who's a genius with plot. And at the time, I had been asked by an editor at a Big Four. An editor at a Big Four had looked at a book of mine, Say My Name, and wanted it, as so often happens, got kicked up to the bean counters. They decided to pass they just released a book they said that was like it or something like that, or I don't know what their excuse was. And so this editor still wanted to work with me, and so we worked out a story together, and I was going to write it for him. And so I worked with Lynn. I'm like, hey, Lynn, can I call in a favor? And I worked with her really closely, certainly as close as I had since grad school back in 2006 before the motorcycle accident that left me kind of, somewhat crippled. And she and her just amazing insights allowed me to do some things I haven't been able to do with character and plots. It's a story of two sisters, Lydia Barrett and Jessica Barrett. Lydia's younger, Jessica's older. Jessica goes missing one night. She dies. But as it turns out, questions begin to arise whether she died or whether it was a murder. It takes place in Southern California in the shadows of the Hollywood Hills. Whose specter looms large, and I think that's the second time I said specter looms large, so I'll try not to do that again. And it's the story of two sisters, again, stand-ins really for two brothers. This time it's right about me and Josh. I wrote about two women. But it's multiple points of view, third person. There's a lot of things happening there. It's a very involved novel, and I think the twist is really, I don't want to bust my arm, pat myself on the back, but I think it's the best twist I have in any book.
Interesting. So this is a mystery. This definitely sounds like it is a mystery. So this book covers 25 years. What time period is it when the story starts And what is happening at the very start of A Moth to Flame?
You know, this is going to sound terrible, but I write so many books. If I don't pull out a book and look at it, I'm not sure I can give you the exact year. I think it starts in 1998, and we're going 25 years later, and we're somewhere around 2016, and I'm terrible with math, so if I got that math wrong, to any math nerds out there, I apologize. But that's roughly the frame. I know I said it the current time before the pandemic because I didn't want to deal with the whole – you know, masking thing. I just didn't want to deal with it. So I also wanted to deal with, it was 1991. The book starts in 1991 because Pump Up Volume had just come out. And that movie has a little, has a small role in the book, just in terms of Hollywood's influence. If you're not from California, Californians have this really, I don't know how to describe it. Everything is cooler than cool. Nothing gets taken totally seriously. Everything's kind of a joke. You know, the people that laugh the most, those struggling with, internal pains or songs like Everyone Hurts by R.E.M. tend to be the people who are struggling most with internal pain and Everyone Hurts. But everything's kind of a joke within a joke. It's one of the things about the West Coast that drives me nuts. I love so many things about the West Coast. But it strikes me as inauthentic, whereas the East Coast, people maybe aren't as nice, to put it mildly, but they're the real deal. And that's what I miss about the East Coast. I go back there and I get in a car and almost immediately you're screaming at somebody and somebody's screaming at you. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm home. I'm home. This is where I belong.
Okay. Now, can you describe Lydia to us? What type of women are they? Are they working careers? What type of careers? What are their passions? Lydia and her sister Jessica, and how old are they? Are these two sisters?
Well, when Jessica dies, she's 18. She's just turned 18.
Whoa!
So that'll factor into the story later on. But Lydia works as a coroner's investigator, and she works on the midnight shift because she has something called mycophobia, which is a fear of the nights. So instead of trying to sleep through the nights and battling those demons, she finds it easier to be awake during the night, walking the streets and sleeping during the day. She has a promotion waiting for her to be the medical examiner. But that's a job that takes place during the day, and she's been kind of putting it off. Her nyctophobia is not severe. It's a mild form. It's enough that, it's one of those things that, like smoking. I'll quit tomorrow. Yeah. But she has a mentor, Maureen, who has been grooming her since she's been in med school and desperately wants her to take over the job of chief medical examiner. And one morning, Lydia, while being as a coroner investigator at the end of the graveyard shift, discovers a body at the bottom of a ravine. Mm. And again, you always have your inciting incident, and that's what sets this story in motion, because the woman whose body is found, her neck is broken in a similar fashion as her sister Jessica's broken 25 years earlier.
Where did this story idea, you have these great story, full of mystery ideas, where did this story idea, the idea for this particular story come from?
Madness. I think all writers are slightly insane. I think all artists, all great artists flirt with madness because to create, I think you have to be a little bit off your rocker. Most writers, I mean, the cliches about writers, being unhappy or being anxious or being, I mean, cliches become cliches for a reason, right? There's things that go on in a writer's mind where you're always kind of imagining these far-fetched scenarios. What if this happened? What if that happened? And then you take it from there. I often will look, get my stories from true crime online, body found, bottom of a ravine, and then I'll go, I'll start with that, and I'll figure out the rest of the story. I don't need to know how it actually got solved. I don't remember if that's what I did with A Moth to Flame. I do know that I wanted the specter of, I keep using the word specter. I don't think I used specter five times in the course of a year, and I've used it five times in the course of an interview. But It's Hollywood is a primary player in the book, because they live just over the shadow from Hollywood, and I can imagine. I spent some time in Southern California during my hobo years. All that glamour, so close to so much squalor. The stark juxtaposition it stands out.
Now introduce us to Mr. Cam Rawls. What's he like? And without giving the story away, what's his pivotal role in A Moth to Flame?
I love Cam. Cam is the only black student in a pretty much all white, rather privileged high school, which presents its own sets of problems and prejudice. And I was writing this while we had another president. And so, my wife's Puerto Rican, and my kids, therefore, have quite a bit of Puerto Rican in them. And, this race stuff was going on, and I wanted to address it in a way without being didactic or pedantic about it. But I wanted to play this. I see what my wife goes through is, being a part of the other, and especially during that time, those 4 years where, the walls are being built and the embargoes, and we're throwing paper towels for hurricane victims. And so I wanted to do that, but without appropriating, obviously, a culture that I am not a part of. And that's a fine line to walk. Cam's a very upstanding, very decent man. His father was also a very upstanding, decent man. But they deal with, a lot of ways, the town I set A Moth to Flame mirrors my hometown of Berlin. Berlin was the demographic of Berlin is pretty, everyone looks pretty much the same. And when everyone looks the same, everyone kind of thinks the same. There's a lot of similarities between the two. And I think a lot of writers do that. You use your hometown and just kind of move it around. Cam was Jessica's ex-boyfriend. They were on again, off again. So he's the local sheriff down there. And he, because they were seen fighting the night Jess died, he is a suspect. So he has his own motivations for either clearing his name, getting away with it, or helping prove who did it. And so he's, both the suspect and the investigator. He's a great character. And Shane Ellett, who is the sort of stoner podcast weirdo who started this all back in the day when his name was, he would go by the Rider on the Plane, and he would go and have a pirate radio broadcast. This is where I ape the pump up the volume storyline from. Of course, he did it as a joke. He did it as a lark. And he comes back into play because now it's many years later and he has a YouTube channel and he's still doing the same shtick, although now it's called, Night Rider or something. God, I wish I could remember. I really do write so many books. They blend into each other.
Sure is,
and
yes.
I started thinking.
Very prolific writer. Absolutely. You know what? When I listen to it, I find that readers, it's the characters. It's the characters. When the readers start to really care about the characters and what's happening to the characters, you do a good job describing your characters. Can you introduce us to one or two other major or minor characters who make an appearance in A Moth to Flame?
Well, Maureen Guerin, who is Lydia's mentor and mother figure, plays a huge role. And then there's Lydia's actual mother, Gloria Barrett, who blames Lydia for letting Jess go out the night she was killed. She was attending a protest for a teacher of theirs, a very popular young teacher who had just been fired. But the funny thing about characters is I have, and I've tried to get away from this, and it's probably what's prevented me, well, maybe this and then a lack of talent, from being a bestseller on the New York Times list. I don't find likable characters very interesting. I just don't. I know there are some amazing writers and guys I've met and who I have the utmost respect for, Lee Child and Michael Connelly and James Patterson, just amazing writers, and whose characters are very honorable and very, they have a lot of integrity. I think because of the time I spent, basically, on the dole in the you know, bowels of the Mission District of San Francisco, I met a lot of people who weren't so admirable. And what I found was that there was still something about people who, on the surface, you'd look and you'd see a drug addict who had a kid living in a terrible hotel, and you'd say, "Well, God, that guy shouldn't have a kid." But when you got to know them, you'd realize they loved their children as much as I love mine. They were drug addicts. They were criminals. They weren't good people, quote unquote good. They were deeply flawed, but it didn't stop them from loving their children. You know, there's a humanity I try to infuse in all these characters who society sort of casts aside and instantly dismisses based on, well, I mean, with some very good evidence. I mean, doing drugs is wrong. I'm not trying to say doing drugs is a good thing. It was probably the worst decision I ever made in my life. And being a criminal is not something I advocate. You know, I see cops now, I wave to them, and I'm very happy they're patrolling my neighborhood. But there is something about life in that gutter where you can find beauty among the trash. And I always love that, you know, that light at the end of a very, very dark tunnel. Or, you know, how Dennis Lehane describes noir, you know, you're falling from the curb to the gutter, something like that. I think that's the quote. Dennis went to the same MFA program I did, although he graduated earlier. And I don't know, he's had slightly more success than I had. I don't know, it's debatable. But I find something just deeply romantic about that world. And I think it's part of how I grew up. I grew up, you know, my mom and dad were very young. My mom was 16 when she married my father at 19. And I was raised in part by my alcoholic grandmother. And I spent a lot of time, you know, in these kind of tenement apartments in neighboring towns that had bad reputations. And, you know, I'd watch her with her boyfriend / husband and the OTB slips and them getting drunk, and the days when the big wins came in, how happy they would be, and the days when the big losses came in, how violent it could get. And I love my grandmother dearly. She was one of my favorite people ever. So this isn't to in any way besmirch her memory. She was flawed. I find deeply flawed characters the most interesting. I was fortunate enough when I was at FIU to interview Russell Banks. And if you haven't read his Affliction, you will never find a better book on what it's like to live in rural New England. And if you can only read one book and it's mine or Russell Banks, I urge you to read Russell Banks. It's fantastic. Affliction is just absolutely amazing. But I did the interview with him, and what I talked about him about this likable character thing, because I was already getting that kind of that blowback. And he said he didn't care about if his characters were likable. He said, you know, they had to have something worth redeeming. You know, he had to have something interesting about them. He said his characters were all wounded. I love that. They're all wounded. And we're all wounded in some way. Everybody, you know, all these adages, everybody's fighting a battle you know nothing about, or any of the other, you know, myriad tropes you hear. It's true. I mean, everybody's struggling. Everybody's fighting something. And, you know, Jerry Seinfeld does this great bit where he's like, everybody's life sucks. Your life sucks. My life sucks. My life might suck less than yours, but it still sucks. I love that. Like, you know, we all have problems. Mm-hmm. I find problems interesting. I find problems compelling. I find people who aren't the nicest of people to be the ones I want to write about. And unfortunately, there has been a disconnect between that and a larger readership. And I love Oceanview Publishing. They gave me my start, and I would never say a bad word about them, but they were always telling me, can't you make Jay more likable? And I was like, I could, but the guy's divorced. He's an alcoholic. He can't see his son. His brother just died. He feels guilty over it. Like, and he's got a foul mouth. Like these are the guys I know. That's how my brother was. They work in trenches and fields, and they don't say heck and darn. You know, they use the big words, and they're not and totally in charge of their emotions, and they have some rage issues. And I think you have to be authentic to your characters. I wouldn't have become a novel writer. I would have gone to screenwriting, because the stats of book reading, as you know, are just dwindling, and it's very difficult. I mean, I think it's one out of 25 or one out of four people, 25% reads a book after high school. one out of four.
Wow.
It's a single book after high school. And it's devastating, especially, you know, as a writer, and my kids are sitting there watching YouTube, and I'm like, read a book. And they're like, they're kind of boring. I'm like, it's sort of what I do for a living. It's kind of how, you know, live in this house and stuff. Like, you know, it'd be nice if you could not at least say that to my face. My oldest, I'm not supposed to mention their names on the air because my wife, we started to get creepy letters, and sometimes it happens. But I have a very hard time not mentioning their names because they have great names. One is named Holden after Holden Caulfield. The other is named Jackson Kerouac after Jack Kerouac. And I have a great story about Holden, how Holden got his name, that if I can work it into this, I'll share with you. But Catcher in the Rye was another one of those books that was, I mean, to me, it's the greatest book ever written, and it's a book I read at least once a year. And this will speak more to my mind. This will probably answer your question better than I've answered it. I thought Holden Caulfield was right when I read that book when I was 18 years old. I thought he was right when I read it when he was 30, and I read it last year when I was 52, and I still think he's right. The world's full of a bunch of phonies, and I understand teen angst because I think a part of me, maybe, you know, in a large part because drugs stunt your emotional growth, but a huge part of me remains at 16. You know, teen angst comes about because it's the age where you realize that people you love the most have been lying to you all along. You can't, you know, you've been told you can be anything you want to be. It's what's on the inside that matters if you try hard enough. All these accolades you have to tell kids because you have to encourage them. But the truth is, no, you can't be anything you want to be. If you can't hit a curveball, you're not playing right field for the New York Yankees. You know, there's a good chance you're probably not playing any professional sports. Very few become professional musicians to make enough. Very few become writers to make a living at it. It's, you know, there's much more practical trades out there to earn a living. And so when you get to hit to be 16, though, you realize all these things you've been fed have kind of been lies. And these are the people who you love the most. So it creates this disconnect between you and authority, and that's where you get, you know, so much of the rebellion from. And I never really grew out of that phase.
Now, A Moth to Flame, does the book's title hold a special meaning? I love that title. Does it have a special meaning?
It does. The character I was talking about, Shane Ellett, who is his show is called Nightshade, not Knight Rider. Knight Rider was that show about talking car. I don't know, I got that confused. His show is called Nightshade, and he does this weekly YouTube podcast or vlog or whatever it's called. I don't know. My kid is always watching YouTube, so I'm like, I'll work that in there somehow. But he goes by he calls himself the Moth because he's drawn to the light and the darkness. So that plays in. And also, A Flame is this book that takes place as the climax. You know, we race towards our exciting conclusion. A wildfire has broken out in Southern California and is racing towards a town. So you have that ticking time bomb, you know, speeding up the action. So there's a few layers to that title. I also love a song by Rex Chapman called A Moth to Flame. Every book I write gets a soundtrack, and I write to music. Being a musician, I find that writing to music helps me with cadence and rhythm, and there's a musicality of language that I feel often is overlooked by many writers. The things I find fascinating, sadly, most others don't. So
your larger audience, I'm sure you would tap into them. You've written so much.
I have a very, very loyal, very dedicated fan base for whom I am deeply appreciative. They've kept me going. I get letters all the time. I get emails all the time. I get phone calls. People telling me how Junkie Love changed their life. Usually it's from people in prison. Apparently Junkie Love gets passed around in prison a great deal. And they always write me, prisoners, without a doubt, to a person, ex-convicts are the most polite people on the planet. When I get written by an ex-con writes me, I always know because it's Dear Mr. Clifford, and they are so polite, so sincere, so just respectful. I can tell instantly I am talking to somebody who served time. But I often get letters saying, you know, I was in prison and, you know, I was doing 15 years and, you know, I don't care what they were doing their 15 years for. But they're like, you know, somebody passed along Junkie Love. You know, somebody got a copy of it. We passed it along all through the prison and we all read it. And they always apologize, saying, sorry, I didn't buy it. And I'm like, no, man, like I didn't get into this for the money. And I, you know, everyone has their own view with money. I just don't care about it. I don't, you know, when I don't have it, I find that God finds a way to get it to me. When I have it, I give it away. That is an attitude that infuriates my wife. I could get into more depth, just so much. It's currently infuriating my wife. But anybody listening to the show who knows me knows what I'm talking about. But yeah, I mean, money to me is you know, when I get one of those letters, when I get a letter from somebody saying, "Hey, you know, my daughter died of heroin addiction, and your book helped me come to terms with that," that to me is worth its weight in gold. So you can keep your $50,000 advance because I changed somebody's life. And that to me is what this whole human experience is about, that kind of connection and leaving the world a better place than you found it. And which is slightly antithetical if you know me, because I'm not the most pleasant of people, to put it mildly. I'm rather grumpy. I have one of those resting faces that looks like I'm perpetually angry. I developed a scowl at a very young age. Whenever we used to smile, our father used to make fun of us, and he raised his name, so I won't say what he'd call us, but he did not like smiling around the house. So I developed this scowl, and I still have to this day. I don't even realize I'm doing it, but I always look angry. And I don't even know where I'm going with this. Probably from all the drugs I did. I did some brain damage, so you'll have to remind me of the question because I get lost.
No, and you know what? So you were talking about Junkie Love, and I wanted to touch on that. We have a little less than 15 minutes, and I also wanted to talk about your music before the show wraps up. But how old are you when the book Junkie Love starts? Did you start out with your childhood? And why did you decide... Is this autobiographical? I think it takes courage to write an autobiography. Why did you decide to pen the book? And how old are you when Junkie Love starts?
I started writing my recovery memoir while I was still using. I was with an ex-wife down in L.A. just about maybe a month before it all really came crashing down. And I wrote the first line to the book, "All the Ordinary People with All Their Ordinary Concerns." That is the only line from the original draft that has stayed. But I'm around 26 at the time. The book opens up at this house we were staying at that was called Hepatitis Heights. So nicknamed because everybody there, not me included, but for the grace of God, had hepatitis. It's a very common disease among intravenous drug users. I somehow was spared that. And the other big one, just... don't ask me, you know, through the grace of God. But we're waiting there one day, and I'm watching a TV show. We had a little tiny TV show. Cops was on TV, and they were raiding the cops were raiding a drug den. And at the same time, all of a sudden we hear, you know, the windows busting in and the doors busting in, the cops busting through our doors as this is happening on TV. I mean, we weren't on the TV show, but it was happening, real life, happening simultaneously, and a lot of people living at the house were also doing methamphetamine, which produces profound paranoia. You know, so I'm standing in the hallway and I'm saying to the cops, I'm like, you know, this is, you have no idea what you're doing to us. Like all day long, you have to tell people on speed, like they're not being followed by the FBI or DEA, where you're not being, because they always think they're being followed. And then here it was, it turns out just because you're paranoid doesn't mean it's not true. And that's how the book starts, and we take it from there. So the book's a nonlinear, much like a drug addict's fractured mindset. It goes back and forward in time until we get to the end where we hit a straight timeline with the recovery stuff. But it's a lot of intersecting stories of close calls, brushes with death, overdoses, you know, bank robberies, all that kind of fun stuff, the stuff you do when you're just a wacky junkie out there on the street.
Now, what caused you, Joe, to decide to finally get clean and stay clean? Was there a special event, or was there somebody, a person who entered your life? What caused you to do that?
There's two big ones. One's going to make me sound like a really nice guy, and one's going to make me sound like an absolute creep. So we'll start with the one that makes me sound like a nice guy. My mom was dying of scleroderma, and I did not want her to see – I didn't want her to go out seeing her older son that, you know, a junkie. It just – she was such a wonderful woman. What she gave up for us, what she put up from our father, who was abusive to say the least, you know, just raising three kids on her own. She was an amazing woman, and she catches scleroderma and cancers, and she's dying. And I just did not want to see her. I didn't want that to be her last memory of me. That's the noble part. That's where I check myself in. I go back to school. I get on the Dean's List, Honor Society. I get my scholarship over to FIU, you know, free ride and all that stuff. The other part that's equally true, and sadly, maybe even much more of a inspiring factor, was I was looking at some serious jail time. We were printing checks to ourselves and cashing them at various banks. It was it's a dumb junkie plan hatched by a bunch of dumb junkies, because eventually you are going to get caught. You know, there's only so many times you can go into a bank with a check. People go dumpster diving down the financial district, and if you didn't tear up your financial documents, we'd get account numbers, and we'd run them through a computer and print up these checks, and we'd send, you know, just send junkies into cash. I mean, every check had to be $800. Over $800 was a different crime. So every check we were cashing was for, you know, $799.94, because junkies have to squeeze every last cent. My girlfriend got arrested. I went in to see what was wrong. Then I got arrested. And I was sentenced to do the Sheriff's Work Alternative Program. I wasn't showing up at 7 o'clock to do a job, because if I could do that, I wouldn't be a junkie in the first place. So I ran. I fled. And I checked myself back in the school. And when I did well, California has a very generous, very gracious San Francisco a program called the Clean Slate Program, which it's your one chance at redemption. It's your one chance to say, hey, all right, here you go. We'll give you a second chance. And I had professors write on my behalf, citing, you know, the time I've been clean and what I'd accomplished. And I was at that time president of the literary club and you know, English Society, Honor Society, and Dean's List. And California waived all of these charges from my, they expunged my record, which allowed me to return and do what I did. And I can't thank the people in the recovery community, the people who, the counselors, you can't give them enough credit. They really are they're like the teachers of drug addiction. You know, teachers don't get enough credit and rehab counselors don't get enough credit. And some of the rehab counselors who talk to me, were able to make such an impression. You know, I later made them characters in books, you know, under pseudonyms. I can never thank them enough. And of course, you can't call by name because it's, you know, the whole anonymity thing. But yeah, those were the two factors that spurred my rebirth, I guess, if you would.
Oh, well, so happy for you. And I'm sure your children and your wife just are tremendously appreciative that you took that path. Now, you're also in a band. What's your role? Are you the lead singer? Do you play an instrument in a band?
Yes, I'm the lead singer. Obviously, with an ego like this, no, I'm the lead singer. I play guitar. I play piano. The really cool thing was the first song that started this record was a song I wrote when my brother was dying, and I wrote a song on piano for him. Just talking about, because we knew he was going and we knew he wasn't going to last long, and I wanted him to hear it. I made a rough demo, and he was like, yeah, it's all right. That's how my brother was. But the cool thing about this was that I got to bring in my youngest son, Jack, and he sings on the final chorus of that song. And my youngest, Jack, he was 8 at the time, and it's very difficult to sing in key at that age, but he can sing in key. He's got a wonderful voice. He's got a great musical talent. He's very theatrical. He's taking theater classes. So I think, unfortunately, he's taking after Dad, and that he's got that art thing, that art bug. So I wish him well. But that was super special, because he only got to meet my brother Josh a few times. But they had their own bond, I think, being, as you know, the second born. And, you know, to Jack, who was, you know, this tiny little peanut. And then you had Josh, who was just this, you know, gigantic monster of a human, just a huge guy. I can only imagine what it looked like. But Jack had a special bond with him. To get him in the studio to sing on A Better Machine, to sing on the track What's Up for Josh, The Wandering's last studio effort was really, it brought everything full circle. There's a parallel between my boys, and it's obviously something I'm projecting, because, you know, but there's a 4-year age difference between the two. My birth month is the same as my oldest birth month. My second and Josh's birth months are the same. So, you get a chance, I think, in life to repair some of the damages you did. And you have to be careful, of course, because you don't want your kids, you know, having to, you know, pay for your sins. But you do get it, you know, having kids is another chance to sort of, I don't know, pass along some knowledge and wisdom. Hope they listen to some of it, which they listen to, yes, if you have a kid, you know, they don't listen to much of it. But you hope they listen to some of it. You hope to spare them some of the hard luck lessons you've learned, and make their life a little better. And, mm-hmm. you know, be the parent that maybe you wish you had more of.
Mm. What is it like performing in a band? And do you have any albums out? And if so, can you give us the title of some of your albums or some of the songs your band has put together?
Well, you know, we're going to do a record release party. The latest record, A Better Machine, we were lucky enough to get Franz Nicolay, who plays in New York's The Hold Steady. I interviewed him, and he plays keyboards on the record. He's just an amazing human being and musician. But we got, Michael Urbano, who drummer for Cracker and Smash Mouth and a bunch of other big bands, and he plays drums. And we got Micah Schnabel from Two Cow Garage to do some guest work, and Mike TV from Guests That Go. I mean, just the who's who of these people I've been fortunate enough to interview or meet. And I called in and was like, hey, you want part of this record? And it was a magical sort of experience. A Better Machine is the record I've been trying to make for, you know, since I first picked up a guitar back in 1986. It's you know, you can find it on Spotify. It's under The Wandering. It's also under our previous name, The Wandering Jews. The Wandering, there's several bands named The Wandering. The Wandering Jew, based on the story of the man who saw Christ, denied his existence and was cursed to wander the earth forever. It's also a plant. But living in Berkeley, I've had to defend the name so many times. After a while, I'm like, oh, let's just call the band The Wandering. There was never anything remotely equated to what's going on now or that conflict. But Berkeley is a very, very sensitive area, and after a while you get tired of telling the same story. But you can find us under both names, The Wandering and The Wandering Jews. And we'll be playing our first show in a couple of months. Somebody bankrolled it, and we're going to put it on. So I just have to get the old band back together. It's a lot of instruments on this new band. We got you know, sax and keys and God forgive me, flute, which means a little time in rock and roll jail for that one. But it's pretty awesome, man. We got, you know,
okay.
my first bass player from when I just came out here, Matt, plays, he was in my first band, The Creeping Charlies, which is a previous iteration of The Wandering Jew, which is another reason why I named The Wandering Jews, because Creeping Charlies is before Wandering Jews. And not that I'm big into plants, but, you know, when you do drugs, your mind makes strange connections. And so, yeah, I got to play with all these great musicians, and we're going to do a record release party sometime in May. And you can find us on all the...
Oh, my goodness. I hope you have information on that at your website, joeclifford.com, so our listeners can even check out your music. And if they're in the area, come and enjoy the performance. Now, where can off-the-shelf listeners get a copy of your book, Joe?
Well, if they want to pay for it, you can go to Amazon or any fine retailers anywhere. If you're struggling and you're having a hard time with money and you still want to read it, you can write me, joe@joeclifford.com, and I'll send you a copy. Like I said, I don't do this for money, and I certainly don't make a whole lot of money handing out books, but that's what I do. You know, I mean, so. You know, you can find me. I don't want to say I sit around Googling my name because that would make me sound so vain and egotistical. But had I sat around Googling my name, I can tell you I'm the number one Joe Clifford on Google. Me, number one.
Okay.
So you can just put my name in a search engine, and I am very easily, as the boss says, found in darkness on the edge of town.
Go ahead.
No, that's it. That's all I got.
Okay, we have had
enough of your time.
No, we have had, you've been a wonderful guest. We've had the pleasure of interviewing Joe Clifford, and his website is joeclifford.com. Oh, my goodness, what a wonderful interview. If you came in midstream or late, wherever you list catch off-the-shelf books, no worries. Once the show finishes streaming, you can go back and listen to it in an archive as many times as you like and share it with book lovers. He also is into music, so you can share it with people who enjoy music. Very, very honest author guest on here on Off the Shelf Books. And I really encourage you to keep up with Joe. Again, his website is joeclifford.com. And he's the author. He has written so many books. This is why I really encourage you to go to his website. We talked about A Moth to Flame. We really only talked about three of his books. Some we got into Junkie Love, and then his thriller book series. We talked about that briefly, but oh my goodness, we would have been here for hours if we had talked about all of his books. He's a very prolific writer. So I want to thank Joe for being here with us on Off the Shelf this morning. And to our listeners, thank you as always for catching Off the Shelf Books. Just set a note on your calendar. Saturday mornings, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time or New York City time, you're going to catch Off the Shelf Books where you can be introduced to and learn more about other great guests, all things story, just like Joe Clifford. And as I always tell you, you are amazing. You are phenomenal. Go out and create a fabulous day for yourself. Joe, I'll send you a link to the show when it finishes streaming. Thank you. Bye for now.